Good morning and welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. I'm Rick Recking, most recently the registrar for our very successful retreat. For those of you that couldn't make it, we had a great time and really the weather was terrific. So Prairie is a lay-led organization. We welcome people of every ethnic and religious background. Whatever your color, sexual orientation, gender, or family structure. We welcome you no matter what are your abilities or inabilities. Later in the service, we'll have an opportunity for guests and visitors to introduce themselves or reintroduce themselves if they've returned after a short period away. On Sundays, we provide a wide variety of different kinds of services, either from our consulting minister, Sandra Ingham, from members of our community, or from members of the wider communities we have today, Chris Taylor from our Wisconsin State Legislature. Our opening words are from the UU Songbook, number 440. It says, from the fragmented world, and from the fragmented world, let us labor in hope for the dawning of a new day without hatred, violence, and injustice. Let us nurture the growth in our own lives of the love that has shone in the lives of the greatest men and women, the rays of whose lamps still illumine our way. In this spirit we gather, in this spirit we pray. By a gentleman by the name of Philip Hewitt. Patty's going to light our chalice this morning from number 560 in the hymnal under prophetic words and deeds of prophetic women and men, and this one by Dorothy Day. Commitment. People say, what is the sense of our small effort? They cannot see that we must lay one brick at a town at a time, take one step at a time. A pebble cast into a pond causes ripples that spread in all directions. Each one of our thoughts, words, and deeds is like that. No one has a right to sit down and feel hopeless. There's too much work to do. And Faith Colvin came to our program committee a couple of months ago and said, we need to have Chris Taylor. So Faith, will you come up and introduce her? And she went ahead and organized this, so I'd like to turn the introduction over to Faith.
Well, I'd just like to say, a couple years ago, through Yahara House, I got a job as a page in the state assembly. And through that, we have the gist of what goes on through the state assembly piped into us. And I'm sad to say that most of what goes on through there is very disheartening. But one day I heard a voice, and that voice was the voice of Chris Taylor. And she spoke truth to power in a way that I would. She is an amazing woman. She is just amazing. And you know, I can't describe what I heard. When I heard her voice, I couldn't believe she was a politician. And so I did some research on her. I followed her on Facebook, and I learned a bit about her background, and I know that she is the real deal. She is a spokesperson for the small person, for the woman, for the poor, for the disenfranchised, for all of us without a voice. And from then on, I knew that she is not really a politician. She is one of us. And so I had to have her here. I know many of you know her better than I do. And I just, when the subject came up of corruption of the democracy from within, there's no one better to speak to it than her. So I won't take up any more of a time introducing her. She is one of my heroes. She is. And you know I don't, you know I don't blow smoke. This is Chris Taylor.
Well, thank you, Faith. That was the best introduction ever. I have to say, you know, when you're speaking sometimes on the floor of the assembly, sometimes it feels like nobody's listening to you, I gotta say. So you never know, you know, maybe somebody out there is listening. And so thank you, Faith. And thank you for your service in the state assembly. You know, I'm really honored to be here. Usually I'm sitting where you are on Sunday morning. It's my favorite place. I go to the First Unitarian Society. I've been a member there for a long time. I have two little boys who are in the religious education program there. And I have just gotten such strength from my faith and from my spiritual tradition there. So it's really lovely to be here. And it occurred to me, listening to the Peacock story, there are certain leaders of our country and our state who should have been here this morning listening to the Peacock story. Maybe they could have learned something. So I'm happy, you know, I was told, okay, we're talking about the death of democracy and corruption, these kind of very ominous things. And I'll go through some of why it is ominous and why some of these things are happening. But I'm still very optimistic. You know, I still believe very much in the power of people. And I'm very, very privileged to get to be the voice sometimes of people who might be feeling very disenfranchised and very left behind. But that's really who I'm motivated to represent in the state legislature. So I don't know how many of you followed this, but I was thinking about, okay, death of democracy and corruption, and you know, these are things I think a lot about. And then last Sunday, and you know, usually I'm in church, so I'm not watching the Sunday talk shows, but I try to catch up and see who was on and who said what. So last Sunday, on the heels of the very abrupt firing of the FBI director James Comey, the former U.S. intelligence chief under the Obama administration, James Clapper, was on CNN on the Jack Trapper show. And he said something that was very stunning to me that I really have not seen anybody really who had been very high up in government acknowledged. He said, and this is a quote, "I think in many ways our institutions are under assault, both externally," so referring to Russia, "but also internally." And when asked to clarify whether he meant from the president, he said, "Exactly." And he went on, I mean, this is something you just don't hear often. You know, I was kind of stunned by this. He went on to say, and this is again a quote, "The founding fathers and their genius created a system of three co-equal branches of government." What a concept. "And a built-in system of checks and balances. I feel as though that is under assault and is eroding." So I thought, wow, this is kind of perfect for this talk, you know, I'm going to give, because it really does kind of set the stage for what I want to talk about. It's hard right now to turn on the television and not hear about some other scandal that's happening at the national level. But I have to say, you know, some of this stuff is very eerily familiar, and it should be to us here in Wisconsin. Because, you know, we do have a president who doesn't seem he recognizes basic ethics or legal boundaries or the authority of the other two branches of government, which are supposed to be co-equal. So right now, you know, we have all this stuff happening at the national level, and it's kind of this bright, shiny object, right? We're all, you turn on the television, all you hear is about Russia and about who knew what and who said what. In the meantime, all these really, really damaging things are happening at the federal level that are getting a bit obscured. Like, for instance, I just got my Sierra Club newsletter. I was just reading it this morning, and in this newsletter, they detail these very, very important rules that are being nullified, like a rule to protect wildlife in Alaska that Obama passed to not allow predator control around, you know, bear cubs and wolf cubs and that sort of thing, and that has been eroded. We're seeing the Keystone Pipeline go forward. We're seeing, you know, animals that really have been endangered being taken off the endangered species list. So this was just an example. As all this stuff happens and how we hear about the Russians and who got to take the pictures and the meeting with President Trump and the Russian diplomats, there's some really damaging things going on. So we cannot forget about that. We can't be distracted and not pay attention to what's happening. You know, the real change that I see, and maybe this is because it impacts my work every single day, and I think it impacts you all, is really happening right here at home at the state level. And I think we can look all around the country and see this really since the 2010 elections. There's been really fundamental changes. I do go to the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC. I am a member. I'm not a member because I agree with their philosophy. I'll talk a little bit about them later. But this is really a group that has been around for a long time and is kind of composed of corporations and state legislators and lobbyists from ExxonMobil and Pharmaca, the big kind of drug companies, that pushes out model policies. And this is what this group does. They've been around for 40 years. And so a lot of the things that are coming into our state are not coming from the people of our state. And that's the most alarming thing that I see. That's really where the erosion is coming from. It's coming from these out-of-state special interests, really driven by corporate interests. And that's really what I see as driving the agenda. So I was at an ALEC meeting just in November, so after the elections, end of November, beginning of December, and Newt Gingrich was there. And he extolled everybody. You know, they were somewhat tempered in their victories in the fall. And I think because a lot of the members of ALEC were very suspicious, absolutely, of Trump, that he was not their first choice. But they were certainly very, very, very happy that Hillary Clinton won the election. Anyway, Newt Gingrich was talking about and extolling President Trump to look to Wisconsin and to imitate Governor Walker and the reforms that he pushed through. And really, I think following the 2010 Tea Party wave that turned state houses, not just in our state, but really now there's 25 different legislators that are totally controlled by Republicans. It really ushered in the national rollback on workers' rights, on women's rights, attack on public education, the environment, and civil rights, like the right to vote, really started here in Wisconsin in a lot of ways. We were one of the first states after 2010 to push through a lot of these very damaging things, starting with Act 10, which we all remember. And it started here with Scott Walker in a very complicit legislature and a very complicit high court here in our state. Scott Walker really has dismantled our state government as we know it. He really has. And in the process, he's really kind of alienated and very much diluted the voice of the people. And this is probably my biggest concern. It really seems that the unlimited coffers of the Koch brothers and the Bradleys are dictating the policies that we see that really promote corporate hegemony. It's really about corporate domination, a lot of these policies. And in the process, Governor Walker and the Republican-controlled legislature have really dismantled the central tenets of our government to make it less democratic, to make the people less relevant. And this has not only occurred from the actual substantive policies that we see, so the actual bills that we see, but by the breaking down of the structure of our government. And in the process, who runs it and the interests that drive it. And first of all, and when I talk about the structure of our government, I'm really first talking about how our elections happen here and who gets to vote and who are they voting for? Who do they get to vote for? So the first thing we saw was a voter ID law that really is one of the most restrictive in the whole nation. Now that was held up in court for a period of time, but it is now unfortunately in place. A recent study by Priorities USA, this just came out, estimated that in this last election, about 200,000 people were disenfranchised in our state and were prevented from exercising their vote because of voter ID. And this is despite the fact that the type of voter fraud a photo ID is designed to curtail is voter impersonation. It's you going to the polls and saying, I'm somebody else. Okay, so you're supposed to show a photo to prevent that. Well, that doesn't really happen. We don't really have instances. We do have instances of people maybe voting when they shouldn't. Like we had some 17-year-olds who voted in this last election who weren't eligible. But they weren't trying to impersonate anybody. They were just trying to have a say, and you can't blame them, honestly, because this is this is their future we're talking about. So, you know, this photo ID requirement is designed to prevent something that we don't have. It doesn't happen. We don't have instances of this happening. So this requirement alone was really designed to make it much more difficult for people to vote. And I represent a big piece of UW-Madison. They have done a really great job of trying to get students what they need to vote. But students can only use a 2-year ID to vote. You know, they're there 4 years or 5 years, so they have to keep getting a new ID. It has to have certain things on it that their typical student ID doesn't have. So that was a big change for our state. We really have a very strong tradition prior to this voter ID law and some of the other things I'm going to talk about of encouraging people to vote. We have same-day registration, we had early voting and all of these things. But voter ID really was designed, and it did not, again, come from the people of our state. Nobody really was asking for voter ID. This was something that the American Legislative Exchange Council has been pushing for a long, long, long time, is passing these kinds of very restrictive requirements. The next big change really was the gerrymandering that occurred in our state. So that was when, after the 2010 election, every 10 years you redistrict, you kind of redraw the boundaries. And this, when this happened in 2011, this is now, you know, it was done behind closed doors. So this was done obviously by the Republican majority because they are in charge. It was done out of the Capitol. It was done with a law firm. It was secret. People were asked to sign secrecy pledges. Legislators were asked, Republican legislators were asked to sign secrecy pledges so they would not talk about the process of this redistricting. And neighborhoods were divided. Even honestly, apartment buildings were cut in half. One of my colleagues, Mandela Barnes, they cut his apartment building in half. So on one side of the hall was one district. He happened to not be, well, at first we thought he wasn't in his district any longer. He was on the other side of the apartment building. But, you look at the map and there's these kind of like diagonal districts, kind of these weird ink blot districts. They're certainly not contiguous. Well, experts, so now there's a lawsuit going on, and experts from the University of Chicago who came to testify, because we're challenging the gerrymandering, they said that Wisconsin's assembly districts were the most gerrymandered districts of any state in the last 40 years. The last 40 years. So this was done very, very deliberately. We now know from the lawsuit that it was going to be impossible for Democrats to win more than 39 seats. So that was their goal, is even when Democrats won more votes, and we did win more votes in 2014, significantly more. We won over, it was like 180,000 more votes in 2014 statewide for Democrats. Well, we lost 3 seats in the state assembly. So go figure that. But the decision, these judges, so we challenged it. Judges just recently struck down the gerrymandering, so that was a great victory, I thought, you know, for democracy. We'll see what happens in the U.S. Supreme Court. But this is what they said. We find that Act 43 was intended to burden the representational rights of Democratic voters throughout the decennial period, the 10-year period, by impeding their ability to translate their votes into legislative seats.
Moreover, as demonstrated by the results of the 2012 and 2014 elections, among other evidence, we conclude that Act 43 has had its intended impact. So people have very much have been disenfranchised. So that was another piece. You have voter ID, then you have gerrymandering. Then the other piece that I think we all need to be alarmed about, and a lot of us are doing a lot of work on this, is all this money in our elections. It's absolutely unbelievable. We have elections now in the state assembly with all this independent money that's coming in. It's supposedly independent, although with the gutting, what happened last session was all of our very good campaign finance laws were pretty much gutted here in the state of Wisconsin. So now these independent groups can coordinate with candidates, which was never supposed to happen, unless they have a very specific agreement with yes and nodding of the head that they're in collusion together. But if I went to an independent group and said, boy, it really would be great if you did some mail pieces for me in this part of my district, as long as they don't say yes, that's okay, and that's deemed not coordinating. Wow. Under this law that was passed. So I really went crazy when this law was passed. I think there are very few people who read it. I used to practice, do some campaign finance law when I was a practicing attorney. So I really, this law was probably one of the most alarming things that I saw. It allowed candidates to set up separate entities that take corporate cash. We're not supposed to take corporate cash. We still do have a ban on candidates directly taking corporate money. But under this law, we can set up a separate entity that's run by our spouse or run by our best friend. And that entity can take corporate money, and we can coordinate with that entity as long as we don't say, as long as they don't say yes, we will do that for you. I can certainly direct them on what to do, and so that is now allowed. The cash, really, we really have to keep working on this issue. This is a real concern, because if money is speech, as the right does argue, and this is, they care about the First Amendment in the sense that this argument that I hear at ALEC is, well, we've got to protect the First Amendment because corporations have the right, you know, it's their speech right to spend all this money. The people of our state's voices really are totally muted in these elections if we're going to really say that it's the cash that's equivalent to exercise of your First Amendment rights, which is a very perverse interpretation. So, you know, all of these things have really fundamentally altered who gets elected, who runs, who gets elected, where do you vote, who represents you, and where are they? And this rigged election system, it bleeds into a rigged policy system. And so it's really hard to change some of these policies that I work on without changing who's there passing them. Because when you suppress who votes, and you rig the districts they vote in, you amplify the voices of who's getting these people elected. And it is, you know, a lot of corporate cash and a lot of billionaires are spending a lot of money here in Wisconsin really pushing a certain agenda and really getting people elected who are not paying attention to the public. And that is a huge concern. I want to give you an example of this. So I was on the Joint Finance Committee. That's a committee that gets the budget. That last session I was on that. And we have so many great traditions here in Wisconsin about involving people in the legislative process. So one thing that happens that we still do have, and I wonder how much longer we're going to have this, is when the budget's introduced, the Joint Finance Committee goes on kind of a tour of the state. Now, because Republicans are in charge, we went to pretty much more conservative parts of the state. And the same happens when Democrats are in charge. We go to more progressive parts of the state. But so we went, and people come and testify. And it's really amazing to see hundreds and hundreds of people turn out. They wait hours and hours to give 2 minutes of testimony. But still people come. And I think that's a real testament to the type of participatory traditions that we have here in our state. So last cycle, we were, you know, very concerned that UW was being cut. It was initially a $300 million cut. And our public schools were not being funded adequately, and they were trying to get rid of the scientists and the DNR, I mean, all kinds of things. And the interesting thing is, I never heard anybody come and say, yeah, cut the UW. Never. Not one person said they thought that was a good idea. I did not hear anybody come and say, don't fund our schools in an adequate and sustainable way. And I certainly heard nobody come and say, cut the DNR and get rid of all the scientists. But that's exactly what was done. That's exactly what was done. And so it's a real shock to me. It was a real example to me, wow, they are not listening. They are not listening to the people of our state. So I think that, how does this then translate into what we're seeing in policy, these obstacles, these impediments to the people actually decide making these decisions of who elects them? It's very interesting. The central tenets, I think, of Walker's agenda, Governor Walker's agenda, are very similar to President Trump's agenda. And it's really to decimate government in a couple ways. One is by deregulating. This is a very central tenet of the right now. It's to deregulate. And there's no clearer example than the environment. There really isn't. We debated a bill a couple weeks ago on high capacity wells. And big ag, and this is really big agricultural, they want the ability to get a high capacity well permit. So I'm talking about a permit that allows you to pump 100,000 gallons a day from our groundwater. They want the ability to get this permit and never have it reviewed. So a permit in perpetuity. Well, guess what? The water of the state does not belong. It doesn't belong to me as a policymaker. It doesn't belong to these big agricultural interests. Who does it belong to? It belongs to you all. It's a state asset, and in our Constitution, we are charged as the legislature to protecting this asset because it's yours. It's yours. So what happens when we let an unlimited number of these CAFOs, these big, big dairies, these are not your small local farmer, these are big, big operations, pump an unlimited amount of water from the ground? Well, what we're seeing in the Central Sand, so this is the Stevens Point area, is the streams are running dry. The lakes are running dry. And yet, this is a policy being pushed right now. It's take the government out of it. Take the government out of it. Deregulate. Well, we don't need the government interfering. And so, literally, we see streams and rivers. The Little Plover River has dried up in the central part of our state. So deregulation, very key. Tax cuts, oh my gosh, the tax cuts that have gone on. I mean, it's been about $5 billion in tax cuts, mostly for people who don't need them. We currently, I have a bill to really fight this huge corporate tax giveaway. It's gonna cost us $650 million over the next 2 years. It's called the Manufacturer and Agricultural Tax Credit. And it goes to mostly manufacturers. They don't have to create a job. They can outsource to get this tax cut. And it's going, there's about 11 people who make $30 million or more. That was the last category I could get for the breakdown of who was getting this tax. Who's getting this tax cut? So there's 11 people making $30 million or more who get $22 million under this tax cut. And we're cutting the public schools. We can't invest in our kids. So they love tax cuts. I'll tell you, there is a redistribution of wealth going on, and it's from working people to the super rich in this state, and that's really what it is. So that's another way that, you know, we are trying to, or the Republicans are trying to really starve the government, to starve it, shrink it down. Glover Norquist, you all know who he is, U.S. Taxpayers Party. You know, you want to take government and you want to shrink it so it can, you know, it can be kind of flushed down the he doesn't say toilet, he says bathtub. But that's what the goal is. Now, where do all these things come from? Why, you know, are the people asking for multimillionaires to get more tax cuts? I've knocked on a lot of doors. I go all over the state campaigning for people. I've spent a lot of time in northern Wisconsin. No one has ever told me, I want more tax cuts for the super rich people in our state. So where is it coming from? Well, a part of this agenda, really a big chunk of this agenda, is defined by this very large looming right-wing infrastructure that has been building for the last 45 years. And it's a national infrastructure. It really grew out of the early 70s when corporate America felt very much under attack with, you know, the EPA was coming into, the Environmental Protection Agency was coming into existence. We had the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act. And corporate America got very concerned. We saw affirmative action, and women were getting into the labor market, so all these things were going on. And the launch of this movement is actually attributed to Lewis Powell. Anybody know who Lewis Powell is? He was appointed by the U.S. Supreme Court, by President Nixon at the time. And he was a corporate attorney, so 2 months before he was appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court, he wrote a memo. And you should Google this, because it's so familiar. It's the Powell memo. This is what it's referred to. And it was entitled The Attack on the American Free Enterprise System. And he wrote, quote, "No thoughtful person can question that the American economic system is under broad attack. He laments that a significant piece of this assault on capitalism emanates from universities, students, and professors." It's very, very interesting when you look at the attack that we're seeing on higher education. It's very prophetic in a lot of ways. He notes that why should it be this way? Because corporations pay taxes and fund our public universities, and corporations own the media. So why can't we take this back? And why can't we be the ones who are really advocating for what the agenda is? So he concludes, strength lies in organizing, in long-range planning and implementation, and consistency of action over an indefinite period of years, in the scale of financing available, because they have a lot of money available through joint effort. And this really is where the Heritage Foundation grew out of. So you see the Heritage Foundation, the Cato Institute, and you see ALEC forming in the early 70s. So ALEC, after the 2010 Tea Party takeover in Wisconsin, it really became clear that they were driving, as I said, a lot of the policymaking. They are a menage a trois, so to speak. I don't know any other way to describe it. Of, you know, state legislators, powerful corporations, so as I said, ExxonMobil, Koch Industries, they're right in there, let me tell you, they're funding, and right-wing think tanks, and they really push this agenda of corporate dominance. That is their goal, to maximize corporate profits of their members. So I started going to these meetings when I got elected. Mark Pocan, who's now our congressman, had gone, and he went off to Congress, and he said, you gotta, you know, keep going here. So I did keep going, and it's, you know, I'm always fascinated but horrified about what they're up to. But their agenda really is crushing labor unions and workers' rights. They want to really negate voting rights and really diminish voting rights, consumer and environmental protections, campaign finance reforms. And now they're leading the effort to amend our federal constitution. There is what is called an Article 5 effort going on in our around our state, where these right-wing states are now pushing, calling for an Article 5 constitutional convention that is allowed for in our federal constitution to amend the federal constitution and limit the power of the federal government. This sounds very crazy, I know, but I have to say, you need 34 states to call for one of these constitutional conventions. It's never happened in the history of our country except 17. It happened in 1787. It was led by George Washington. This was the Articles of the Confederacy that were being considered. And guess what? They threw out all the rules and they threw out the articles and they wrote the Constitution. So you don't know how this would go, a constitutional convention. It's very, very scary. But, you know, on all of this, on all of these things, I really do believe that that I still do have great faith in people. I really do. And I have great faith in people because I talk to a lot of people. I meet with a lot of people. And I really do believe that we still, this desire for fairness and justice and equality is really indelibly written on our spirit, on our human spirit, that we have a thirst for justice. I really do believe that. And it really, you know, that thirst, I think, is what caused our nation to form in the first place. And when these things are taken away from people and withheld from people, I do think people do rise up. I really believe that. And we've seen that throughout our history, is that people do rise up when these things are taken from them. Scott Walker certainly inspired me and many others to run for public office. I had never thought I would run for public office until he got elected. And so, you know, he has encouraged not just me, there I have a lot of colleagues, a lot of very progressive colleagues who are fighting these fights, who ran for office because of what was happening. And I see that now, too. I have met with more groups I'd never met with. New groups. Indivisible Madison is rising up. Our Revolution is rising up. People I'd never seen before at events, people I'd never heard from are coming to talk. They want to get engaged. They want to get involved. So I'm really heartened by that. And I think we should take great comfort in that. That is something that is happening. You know, I don't believe democracy is dead. I really don't. I believe it is. I see it flourishing in ways more locally. You know, I look around our community and there are people doing incredible work. There are people who are committed to improving the lives of individuals in our community. And, you know, I don't know how many of you went to the March on Washington or went to the march here in January on the Capitol. I went to Washington, and it was an absolute incredible event for me. Glad I went. I went out alone. I got on a plane, you know, early in the morning. I couldn't find anybody that I was supposed to meet there because there were 500,000 people. I couldn't get cell phone reception. So I marched with people I didn't even know, you know, and it was amazing. There were, I mean, the young people that were there. Across, you know, you had grandmas marching with their grandkids and babies and, you know, people of color, Muslim people, all kinds of diverse people coming together. And there were so many great slogans. Oh, my gosh. I wish I could remember them all. The only one I can remember is the Free Melania. That was one of the signs. I was like, okay, all right, I got that. And then just recently, I want to give you another example of people rising up. The town of Middleton, this is a very interesting thing that happened there. They were scheduled to vote on some zoning issues in the town of Middleton, whether they were going to opt out of Dane County zoning, because the counties typically do zoning. And, you know, there's always kind of this tension with towns. So they were set, the people of Middleton, the town of Middleton were going to vote on whether they wanted to opt out of Dane County zoning. Well, a pro-developer person on their local council there wanted to change the law before the people got a chance to vote. He was very powerful, he's a builder. So he went to the legislature and said, we cannot let people vote, basically. We've got to make it so the board decides and not the people. And this bill was rushed through the legislature. And it was unfortunately timed so no one could run against these couple people who were pushing this. It was already, the limit for running had already expired. So two people launched a write-in campaign, which, you know, almost never work. And they actually were able to beat the two pro-developers who had tried to take the people's voice away. And it was amazing. You know, I thought this is a great victory for local people. And, you know, and the people came out and they voted not to opt out, so the people got a say there. So I see this happening a lot. Look at the school referendums that have passed. I mean, we have like 150 school referendums that have passed in a couple of the last cycles, the most in the history of our state. Well, it's sad why that is. Why, you know, we're going to the people to fund our schools and to invest in our kids, and what a sad state that we don't have a state to do that. But the people are stepping up and saying, we want our communities to thrive, we want our kids to thrive, and we're gonna invest this way. So some quick lessons, I know I'm out of time. How do we keep going, right, in this environment? People ask me all this all the time. How do you keep going? Like what, you know, how do we keep, this is a lot, you know, it's a marathon, not a sprint kind of thing. So a couple things I do. One is I listen to young people, and I listen to our kids. They are so smart and so, you know, thoughtful about these issues. I have two elementary school kids, and, you know, I'd rather my six-year-old and his first grade class be up there running our state government right now. I think they would be fairer, and they would be more honest, and they would be more concerned with protecting our environment and, you know, doing what's right and paying our teachers and all that. So we got to listen to our kids. Our kids always show us the way forward. Kids were sent here to teach us the lessons we needed to learn. Someone said that. I don't know who, but I believe it. You know, take solace in your spiritual community. I cannot tell you what FUS has given to me. I sit in the back row usually. I'm drinking my coffee, and you come and argue all your imperfections. You know, my kids are making noise. Their hair's not brushed. But this is, it gives me so much direction. It gives me direction that we do this work from love, not hate. And you, it's hard sometimes to remember that, believe me. Sometimes I want to take my shoe off and chuck it right across. But I don't. You know, I don't do that because, you know, we have to imitate the moral courage that we talk about here. We have to have that boldness. You know, regardless of who you think Jesus was, right? You read the story of Christ. He was a rabble-rouser. This was not a pacifist just sitting there, you know, not saying anything. This was someone who had the moral courage to speak. And sometimes it's hard to do that, but there have been so many times I've been in my car driving up to the Capitol praying for the moral courage to say what needs to be said. That's what our spiritual tradition teaches us, that we have to have that courage. And then the third lesson, and then I will conclude, is we also have to listen. We can't just be talking all the time. You know, when I came to the legislature, I said, I'm not going to change. I'm going to be who I am. And the thing that I didn't realize is that people will open their hearts to you in so many ways. You know, I've sat with parents who've lost kids to gun violence. And I've sat with siblings who've lost a brother or sister to drug addiction. And that changes you, and it should. It should change you. But by listening, we need to open our hearts and not close them. And, you know, even have more empathy and more compassion for people. So I really believe that, you know, we do have a chance here, that we have a representative democracy that's really the story about people uniting and not being divided and finding our commonalities and where we can work together to move forward. And I think perhaps we are in a rebirth of democracy. Perhaps Governor Walker and President Trump have done something for democracy that has awakened us, but now we got to stay awake. Now we got to stay awake. So with that, I'm delighted. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you this morning. I hope we have time for a few questions. It is tough, I have to say. Are there magic words you can say? No. I think the questions you raise are the good questions. Let me tell you why it's so important for you to show up. And even when it feels futile, believe me. I sometimes wonder, do I even make a speech on the floor? I mean, is anybody listening? And there are people listening. That's the thing. You have at least Democrats on the committee that can take what you said and you asked and reiterate that during the debate to raise that issue again and again. So we have to keep doing this, even when it feels like, they're not listening, they're not sitting down, they're on their phones. It's so extremely important. They want you not to come to testify. Because when you stop coming, they're going to say, nobody cares. Nobody has an issue with this. So even, and I thank you all for sitting there for hours sometimes to testify, but I would urge you not to stop doing it. And you know, even if you're so overwhelmed with all these things to do, what I tell people, pick one thing a day or one thing a week that you can do that's proactive. It's making that phone call. And I do this too. I call Paul Ryan. I mean, I never get through, but I call him. And, you know, I leave messages. We have got to keep doing that, because the day you stop is the day they win. But thanks very much for having me. And I will stick around. I'd love to speak with you. Yeah.
Our closing words are in the hymnal, number 586, and I'll give you a moment to get to it. I'll read the regular type if you would do the italics. The idea of democracy. As labor is the common burden of our race, so the effort of some to shift their share of the burden onto the shoulders of others is the great, durable curse of the race.
As I would not be a slave, so I would not be a master.
This expresses my idea of democracy. Whatever differs from this, to the extent of the difference, is no democracy.
Our reliance is in our love for liberty. Our defense is in the spirit which Christ is liberty, as the heritage of all people in all lands everywhere.
Destroy this spirit, and we have planted the seeds of despotism at our own doors.
Those who deny freedom to others deserve it not for themselves.
Why should there not be a patient confidence in the ultimate justice of the people? Is there any better or equal hope in the world?
Let us have faith that right makes might, and in that faith let us, to the end, dare to do our duty
as we understand it. Thank you very much for coming. Greet your neighbor, and Chris is willing to take your comments.